bit of a stretch. The Diaries of a Prisoner, written and read by Chris Atkins.
This book is written mostly in a diary format and is all in the present tense, apart from two exceptions. At the start of each chapter is a little summary, giving a quick taste of what's coming up. To avoid confusion with the diary entries, we're using some music, like this. Over the chapter breaks, just so it's clear there's a pause in the flow. In the printed book, I've also included some separate text boxes, where I delve into a specific prison issue, like healthcare, infrastructure, or self-harm. These boxes are all written with the benefit of hindsight and are in the past tense. Some music, like this, will play during these text boxes to differentiate these bits from the regular diary entries. Hopefully, it will all make sense. Now, let's get on with the book. Preface. It's about 10 p.m. I'm locked in my cell, H209, with my padmate, Gary, a likeable young scouser who's nearing the end of his sentence for smuggling cannabis. We're watching a film set in an American prison. Not for the first time. I reflect on how popular culture gives an oddly false impression of life inside. The on-screen criminals are ripped, tanned, and seemingly possess all their faculties. It's a far cry from the emaciated, spice-addicted souls who surround me in Wandsworth, many of whom are mentally ill. There's a jangling of keys outside, and our cell door is unlocked. Standing in the doorway is Mr. Hussein, a young screw I get on reasonably well with. "Evening, Chris," he calls to me. "I've just dropped Rob next door. He's having a right mental." "It's not my shift," the officer shrugs. "None of the other listeners will talk to him." My curiosity is piqued. I put on some flip-flops and head out the door. I currently live at the more salubrious end of H Wing, which is an enormous Victorian prison block. The ground floor is dark and deserted, except for a couple of rats sniffing around the bins. We walk down the landing and Hussein opens the door to the listener suite. This name is quite misleading, as it's basically two derelict cells knocked together. The windows are broken and the temperature is barely above freezing. It's harshly lit by a couple of strip lights and it stinks of cigarette smoke. There's no furniture except for three plastic chairs and a revolting toilet in the corner. It resembles a 1970s police interview room and is hardly an ideal space for giving emotional support to vulnerable inmates. Nonetheless, this is where I do most of my work as a listener. I have recently been trained by the Samaritans to help prisoners who are suicidal, self-harming, or just losing their minds. I've now been listening for several months and witnessed more suffering in a single day than I would have previously seen in a whole year. Sitting waiting for me is Rob, a rather large prisoner in his late 20s.
"I'll leave you to it," says Officer Hussein as he locks us in.
Rob is sweating profusely and glares at me through enormous bloodshot eyes. He's wearing his prison clothes inside out, with crazy gibberish scrawled all over the fabric, and he is obviously having some form of psychotic episode. Over the last couple of months, I've become quite accustomed to meeting people suffering severe mental illness in prison. Most of the time, they are far more likely to be the victim of violence from other inmates, rather than the perpetrator. That said, Rob looks seriously scary. I cautiously sit down on the seat furthest away from him.
"Hi, I'm Chris. How are you feeling this evening?"
"What the fuck are you asking me that for?" he hisses.
It's around this point that I regret coming in here alone. Listeners are technically supposed to work in pairs at night, just in case we get stuck in with a dangerous inmate. But over Christmas, our numbers have plummeted while call-outs have soared, so the rules have fallen by the wayside.
"Right, sorry, stupid question, sorry."
I notice that Rob has half a comb sticking out of his hair, and I'm unsure if this is a fashion statement or a potential weapon.
"What do you know about quantum mechanics?" he demands.
"Quite a bit, as it happens," I say. "I actually studied physics at Oxford and it was the only part I found interesting."
We spend the next 10 minutes discussing wave-particle duality.
"I'm seriously impressed with your knowledge," I say warmly, congratulating myself on building up such a strong rapport